We'll open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, the 23rd of January. Colleagues, we have two bills on our schedule to consider today, and I'll begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 147 and asking Mr. Stembridge to give us a brief overview.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 147 requires landscape contractors' license for persons maintaining ornamental irrigation systems using compressed air. It exempts property owner employees from landscape contractor licensing for landscaping work on that property, and it prohibits persons otherwise exempt from licensing as a landscape contractor from representing in any manner to be a landscape contractor.
Okay, I'm going to ask Michael Snyder from the Landscape Contractors Board to come forward. And Mr. Snyder, if any of the other four people are signed up or actually with you, you can bring a couple of them up. Otherwise, I will call them up as they are here.
I'll bring Phil Lynch, he's on the board.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Get my glasses on here. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Mike Snyder. I am the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board, and we have before you Senate Bill 147 that we are introducing to help in the continuous effort to make the laws for landscape industry congruent with the way the industry practices and to clarify anything that's coming up as we use the laws in our administration of these laws. My testimony is there. I can go through that briefly with you. The four different things that are happening on this bill. One is the ability for a licensure to winterize irrigation systems using compressed air. Currently, the law has not given us statutory authority to require licensing to winterize irrigation systems. However, before we became semi-independent in 2002, we were with the Construction Contractors Board, and we inherited all the statutes and the rules as they came over. And there was a rule in place that made the winterization of irrigation systems subject to licensure by the Landscape Contractors Board. In 2007, in the session, we worked with the plumbers and gave them the ability to repair and maintain irrigation piping, which when we reviewed the statutes in 2007, we realized we didn't have the statutory authority to maintain irrigation piping. We have statutory authority to install and repair irrigation systems. And so they stretched the statute, we believe, in the rule to include winterization of irrigation systems as part of repair. So a license was required up to August of 2008 through rule. But when I reviewed the statutes and on advice of our Attorney General, I realized the statute wasn't there to allow us to make that rule. So we pulled the rule. And now we are including that in this session to have the authority for licensure for the winterization of irrigation systems using compressed air, because it especially in the central Oregon, eastern Oregon, and southern Oregon areas, putting compressed air into a system can create a potential backflow problem and a significant damage to an irrigation piping if it's done not done properly. So that's the first issue on that bill. The second issue is it changes the definition of landscape contracting business. The current statute states that a landscape contracting business is a business that offers the services of a landscape construction professional. And what has happened to us in the past, and again on advice of our Assistant Attorney General, the language does not allow us to cite a business that performs landscape work when they don't pay their employees or when they use volunteers to do the work. They may get compensated for the work, but they haven't paid their employees, nor have they've let volunteers do the work. And so we are changing the statute, we'd like to change the statute to include the work to have a landscape contracting business be an entity that provides those services, actually doing that work, and that clears up our confusion with the law. The third issue is that the current statute, we have exemptions for people to perform landscape work without a license, and those are all listed in our current statute, ORS 607-540. However, the exemption is for operating only, and what's happened is that we notice that the statute, the exemption, does not restrict them from advertising or telling people that they're landscape contracting businesses. So they have the exemption to do the work on their own property, but we don't want them going out and saying that we are landscape contracting businesses and that we are landscape construction professionals, because that's not the intent of the licensure. So even though they have the exemption to do that work on their own property or in the general contractor realm, they are not. We don't want them to go out and say that they are now landscape contracting businesses underneath that exemption. And then the last one is it creates an exemption for an employee of a property owner, somebody that is an employee, not an independent contractor, but a true employee of a property owner, to act on the owner's behalf to arrange for or to contract for landscape work on their property, on their own property. That exemption has not been there, even though the board has used that as a policy, that if we have an employee of an owner asking or contracting for landscape work, that employee has always been exempt, but it didn't say that in the statute. The statute today would say they'd have to be licensed, and we'd like to create that exemption so that we go along with what our policy has been. I'd be free to answer any questions.
Thank you. I'll see what comments we have here, and then we'll...
Thank you, Chair Metzger and committee. My name is Joseph Limp. I've been a licensed landscape contractor for about 25 years in Central Oregon, and I'm also currently on the Landscape Contractors Board. And I'm here to testify in support of the licensing of landscape professionals to use compressed air in winterizing of sprinkler systems. It's quite different on the other side of the mountain with our extreme cold. It's kind of the natural thing to use compressed air to blow systems out. And over the years, I've seen many problems caused by untrained people attempting to do that. To become a licensed landscape professional, there's a pretty intense exam, and we also have continuing education units that we have to do to maintain our licensure. So therefore, I'm just going on record as being in support of this change.
Okay, Mr. Lim, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess on this one that restricts those that have exemptions, have you had that problem?
We have not really had the problem. We just noticed that in the last, as we review our statutes and try to make them congruent, we realize that that is a potential problem for us. And we just like to make it very clear that that's not allowed.
Okay, so it's really just a matter of clarification.
It's a matter of clarification.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Okay, Senator George.
Thank you. I'm having a really hard time with the whole concept of adding restrictions to what people can do without a license, especially when it seems like it doesn't seem to be a very big deal. Like in line 9, in the current text of the law, we won't allow people to install lawns, shrubs, which to me doesn't seem like you'd need a license to do some of those things. I understand the issues of construction, like decks and water features and those things. That makes sense to me. And the maintain the irrigation systems. I guess having worked with compressed air my entire life, because I grew up on a farm, I'm a little suspect that what we have here is a situation where we may be trying to, through the licensure, prohibit people from participating in some kind of landscape maintenance that otherwise you wouldn't need to have a license for. And I'm trying to envision in my mind how dangerous this could possibly be. The worst case scenario, if you did it totally wrong, you may blow off a head at one of the sprinkler points. Other than that, I can't think of anything dangerous or even that inconvenient if somebody did this incorrectly. And so what I don't want to do is I can't vote for a bill that's simply meant to protect an industry from competition. And so if you could please explain to me, maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but I cannot think of a scenario where that's actually a dangerous situation. Maybe inconvenient, but it's easy to fix.
Chair Metzger and Senator George, I'll let Joe, he has a lot of experience with that, and some other people in this room also have a lot of experience with it, that be better qualified to talk about that.
Yes, Chair Metzger and Senator George, I can understand your questioning of this. Where the problem lies is when inexperienced people hook up air compressors to blow out irrigation systems, frequently they end up blowing that compressed air back into the domestic supply system because they don't really understand how things are set up. Mm-hmm. And that causes utility companies quite a bit of expense to isolate and sanitize the domestic supply because of the contaminants that have been forced into the system. The compressed air in that supply system can also blow appliances in residences and businesses apart.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Could I get a public utility that would give me an idea of the real significance of this? Because I actually have I'm having a hard time envisioning this, to be really honest with you, that I understand the desire to exclude people from operation, but I would need some additional level of proof to vote for this, simply because of the fact that I have a hard time understanding. Like on the sanitary thing, compressed air, I have a hard time even understanding how that would be a sanitary problem in most compressed air situations. So, I mean, that's what people use when they scuba dive. It's just compressed air with a compressor out back. So if you could give me some examples and see if you can't walk me through to that point. Otherwise, I'd be a no vote. But if you can, then I'd be willing to consider that.
I don't think that I have any specifics. I just know in talking with different utility companies in the Central Oregon area where I work, the hassle and expense they've gone through when people have hooked up improperly. However, I think that possibly a later testimony today might have more clarity to answer your question more specifically.
Great. Thank you very much.
So why don't we do that? Why don't we ask Mr. Schumacher, Mr. Wendell, and Mr. Ramirez to come forward. You've kind of heard the overview. So if you can shed any light on any of the questions that have been answered, that would be really helpful. And identify yourself for the record and where you're from.
You'll be here soon.
Okay.
Great. I'm Bill Schumacher. I own Springtime Landscape Irrigation over in Bend, Oregon. I've been in business there since 1980. I am a certified landscape professional, and I'm a landscape business over there. This rule, basically, we thought it's been in effect for many years, and in concern to Senator George's question, there's a lot of potential harm that can come from the compressed air. The irrigation systems, I don't know if you've heard of fertigation, putting fertilizers in the irrigation system and irrigating a lawn with fertilizers through the irrigation system. Well, if any of the components, say there were pesticide applications going on in the yard, they get back in the sprinkler system, and that system does go back into the domestic drinking water. There is a potential harm there. There are cases which we could find examples for you of that. Basically, we're here to protect the consumer. I've been in business 29 years, and the worst thing for me to do is go up to a customer that has been burned, basically. Somebody that is not licensed, insured, bonded, that is out winterizing a sprinkler system, explodes the system. And we have exploded systems ourselves by not turning the compressed air down. You get a 100 pounds of pressure going through a system. You can blow sprinklers off. You can shatter pipe. And that can be thousands of dollars of repairs. This year, since there's kind of been a turnaround in the rule, we noticed a lot more people, from tire repair people to dog food delivery people, out winterizing systems. I'm sure this spring we will get an abundance of calls, which is good for my business in a sense. I'll have more work in repairing systems that have been damaged. So basically, we're just here to protect the consumer. We know the dangers and the costs that are involved with repairing an irrigation system. So that's my story.
Mr. Ramirez.
My name is Juan Pablo Ramirez, and I'm with Bella Vista Irrigation, and I'm an irrigation professional. And I'm here to testify that I got a phone call from a lady. She's about 80 years old, that she hired some guy that he was in the neighborhood to winterize the sprinklers. And this person inserted the air in the wrong position in the piping and blew enough air to broke all the pipes under the house. So they flooded the house. And he wasn't insurance or bonded, so she don't have any way to track back that guy that did the damage. So she's in a lot of problems, and that's all I have to say.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Questions for either of these two witnesses? Okay, thank you. Can Mr. Wendell show up, or Mayor of Prineville?
He stepped out for a few moments and indicated he would be back by 1:45, but I see it's 1:50 now.
Okay, so. Well, we'll just put this aside for the moment. We're just public hearing today, and then if he shows up, we will ask him to be able to come forward. And
can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator, sir.
And maybe Jim can answer this question. On page 3 of the bill, lines 15 and 16, and then also on page 4 of the bill, lines 36 and 37, I'm just trying to figure out exactly what we're doing in those two particular sections. We renumbered the entire subsection 2, subsection 1 of the bill, or the statute, took out all the numbers and did all the letters. So this says that ORS 671 .530 sub 2 sub 4 sub 5 apply to a person under subsection 1 of this section, which is all of the language on page 2 and the top of page 3. Is that correct? So can you just explain what it is we're accomplishing with this? I mean, it's just confusing when you look and all how everything's getting renumbered. And
Senator Starr, typically, my short answer is I'm not sure we'd be calling Mr. Snyder, but my longer answer is that you have the holding out using the landscape name as one of the bases for licensing, and you also have the activities that a landscaper does, and that's we provided the statute 671.530. It's in your packet, so that you can look at 2, 4, and 6. Those have to do with holding out as a landscape contractor. So in trying to...
This seems like a convoluted way to rewrite the statute. Mm-hmm.
I think what this says is that there are certain exemptions from being a landscape licensee, but if you're exempt from being a landscape licensee, that does not allow you to advertise that you are a landscape business or a landscaper. But again, I believe that others in the agency...
Mr. Snyder, feel free to come back up.
I think I understand that. I think I'm getting a clear picture.
Chair Metzger.
Add any more to that?
Yes.
Interpretation.
You're exactly right, Mr. Stembridge. Legislative Council did all the renumbering. We didn't ask for all that.
I'm
so that's
sure.
All.
I'm sure. I wouldn't play that on your feet.
Your committee administrator said it's exactly right. Even though they have the exemption, they do not then have the right to advertise as landscape contracting businesses or landscape construction professionals. So it's about the intent of the law. The law is not clear in that the way it's currently written, we are making it very clear that that is not something they are to do, even though they have the exemption to perform that work in certain circumstances. Does that clarify that?
I think so. Just the way that they read the statute.
I know statutes are fun.
When you reference other statutes in this statute and then you take certain sections, it makes it more difficult to make the dots connect.
We deal with it day to day.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 147, but we'll reopen if Mr. Wendell returns. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 172. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 172 extends the State Board of Tax Practitioners licensing requirement to persons who prepare for compensation corporate tax returns, partnership tax returns, S-corporation tax returns, trust tax returns, and estate tax returns. And to add, currently the license is required for preparing personal tax returns only.
Okay. We have a trio of members of the Board of Tax Practitioners who have signed up. So we're going to, you know, we may ask you all kinds of questions today. It's free. So come on up. But you have to give us advice that's worth less than $50.
Got it.
Welcome. I'll let you decide who wants to go first.
Well, I will. Good morning, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Ron Wagner. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Tax Practitioners. Thank you for your interest in our bill and for hearing it so early in the session. Just a brief background. We're a consumer protection agency as well. We've been in existence for 36 years. We're currently the only state in the nation with an active program to test and license those who prepare tax returns for a fee. We are recognized as a state nationally as a model for other states and for the federal licensing program that is being looked at by the IRS. I think we do a very, very good job at what we do protecting consumers, but certainly there's always something we can do better, that's why we're here and why we have proposed this bill. There are cases where consumers or taxpayers are not served well because those who prepare the corporate or a partnership, a trust or a state return were not knowledgeable or competent to do so. We don't believe that it's due to a willful negligence. Generally, I believe it's due to innocent mistakes. We and other states in the U.S. Senate see the importance and the benefit currently realized by personal income taxpayers, consumers in Oregon. So what we want to do is we want to expand the consumer protection to these other entities. The U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report in August of last year of 2008 to the Committee of Finance from the U.S. Senate. In there, they highlighted a couple different things. One was that an absence of regulation created inaccurate returns. And on the other hand, certainly with regulation, it increased accuracy. Yeah, if you would. Thanks. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure what I did with my... Oh, it's right here. Too many papers. If I can just quote from this GAO report, what was amazing on the GAO report, the very heading of that, and I believe that you have a copy of that, the heading on their report itself says, my quote, Oregon's regulatory regime may lead to improved federal tax return accuracy and provides a possible model for national regulation. So, you know, great kudos to the state of Oregon for the insight by the industry 36 years ago to do this. And just to quote real briefly, it says, according to the GAO analysis of the Internal Revenue Service's tax year 2001, Oregon returns were more likely to be accurate, while California returns were less likely to be accurate compared to the rest of the country. In dollar terms, the average Oregon return required approximately $250 less of a change in tax liability than the average return in the rest of the country. Based on 2001 tax year, which is for, it says, for Oregon's 1.56 million individual tax filers, this equates to over $390 million more in federal income taxes paid in Oregon than would have been paid if the returns were as accurate as similar returns in the rest of the country. Based on the most recent tax year, 2007, where Oregon had approximately 1.7 million individual returns, at the same rate, it would be $425 million additional federal tax, or at the state level, I estimated, would be about $175 million. So I think, as we can see, and as this report shows, it's been very effective, the program that Oregon has had to regulate those who prepare personal income tax returns. We believe that it would be wise to also regulate these other preparers who prepare these other entity types that are not currently regulated. I believe the GAO report shows that it serves the consumer better. There are more accurate returns filed. It also, as the report, helps to close the tax gap, more dollars to the state general fund. What we're looking for really is not so much a hammer to hold over the heads of those that prepare the returns. The most important is that it requires the initial to show that they show their initial competence and their required continuing education. We believe the GAO report seems to back this up, combination of testing for the licensing and requiring the yearly ongoing continuing education improves the accuracy of returns filed, increases money into the general fund. The additional piece, the hammer, just simply gives us a tool to deal with issues and provide consumer protection by allowing us to investigate, to mediate for consumers, and apply fines where it's appropriate.
Okay. My name's Alan Twombly. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name's Alan Twombly. I'm an enrolled agent and a licensed tax consultant and also the vice chair of the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. I'm here just to make a few statements. I have a large area that I oversee. I have 13 offices, so I have offices both on the coastal range in the Portland metro area, and I have offices in the rural areas. And just giving us, just from what I see in my offices, giving us the ability to regulate our own licensees. We have licensees that prepare corporations, partnerships, trusts, and if we have a complaint or anything, even though they're under our licensure, we can't even mediate or do anything because we currently do not have the ability to, because those aren't in our current statutes. And so I think, if anything, it's just an extension of our ability to protect the consumers. And that's really pretty much what I have to say.
Thank
you. Okay. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Johnston. I'm currently chair of the Board of Tax Practitioners. I have been practicing, well, I'm also an enrolled agent and a licensed tax consultant, but I've been practicing in this field for 38 years. I have had my own business for 31 years, and I first became aware that we didn't cover, originally when we were licensed, we assumed this covered everything. But I first became aware that corporate returns, partnership returns, estates and trusts were not under the jurisdiction of our board, probably 5 years or so into owning my own business. When a couple came in to me, they had been to another practitioner. That practitioner set up all small businesses as corporations, and which she shared with me so that I would not be governed by the board. When these people were upset about their return, they were feeling they were having to pay a lot more tax. Yes, they were, because as being corporation, they had to. He was strictly had one truck. Long-haul truck. That was it for a business. And he was incorporated. He did not totally understand the difference of the two entities, is having to have pay, you know, keep the books separate and all that stuff. And so I helped him get that straightened out. I also discovered several errors in the preparation of her return. We eventually took her to small claims court, or the people did, my clients did, to get her to pay for the preparation, my preparation fees, as I had to totally redo all of those returns that she had done, about 3 years' worth. And then we went to the board hoping, you can get a judgment against somebody, but you can't get them to pay sometimes. And so she left the area. I went to the board to find out where she was. They knew where she was. They told us where she was. But as far as corporate returns, no, we have no jurisdiction, and there was nothing they could do. And that was when I first became aware that this, you know, and I'm sure that the incident is out there. It may be not as prevalent as you would think, but I know it's out there. And there is some negligence going on. Our board is to protect consumers. That's the whole point.
I have a question for you. How many complaints does the board generally, and the department and the board generally hear about in terms of practitioners who are unlicensed that receive some information or questions about? How commonplace is that?
I've been with the board a short time, less than a year, so I don't have a big background. Unfortunately, we don't have any detailed records about that because we don't have jurisdiction. When we do have questions that come into us, we simply respond and say, we're really sorry, but there's nothing we can do as a board. We do not have jurisdiction over those who prepare corporate or partnership returns. So the board has, to my knowledge, not kept any records.
I would think that, in my own experience, I use a CPA, does my personal return, you know, my S-Corp or my LLC, whatever the case may have been at the time. So I would imagine it would just seem to make sense that if this person is doing a corporate return, right, a trust or anything like that, it's a good chance they probably did their personal return too.
Probably.
And so what you're saying is that they goof up the personal return, you can do something about it, but they can't do anything about the corporate return.
Correct.
Part. I see. Okay. Interesting. Senator George.
I don't know if you heard from the earlier testimony. I have a very high level of threshold when people are asking. When a board comes to us and asks for additional regulations of their own industry, I'm always very suspicious that what they're trying to do is protect some kind of quasi-monopoly or oligopoly of people who can do it to eliminate competition. Anybody ever says they're trying to protect the consumer, I always look at it and try to say, okay, where is that threshold? And it's a very difficult line for us to draw. So understand where I'm coming from. In reading in the comments here, it says there's somewhere between 50 and 200 additional tax preparers that would be need to have become licensed under this. And what I'd really like to do is there any of those folks that we could possibly talk to of their justification on why this type of regulation is not necessary? Because it seems like to me, like Senator Metzger said, when I send my returns out, I send them all to my CPA because they have to do all of them coordinated with my personal returns. And I'm having a hard time. I can actually see an out-of-state corporation have a CPA from out of the state prepare their returns and wouldn't need to use a state person. And they would have to be then regulated. They'd have to use something. What I'm trying to do is figure out who these people are and maybe get their side of the story, because I'm having, again, this high tolerance and high suspicion of people that come in and ask for more regulation of their industry. I always believe that it's about protecting their providers rather than protecting the consumer. So if you could maybe expand on that, I'd really appreciate it.
We have to. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, most of the folks who would come under this are already licensed by us. The majority of people that prepare corporate returns to these other entities are already licensed by us. However, all we can regulate is what they have done in the preparation of personal income tax returns. If they also prepare a corporate return, which they're allowed to do in Oregon, if they create harm to the taxpayer, there's nothing we can do, because our jurisdiction is the preparation of personal income tax returns only, not to any other of these entity types. So as far as increasing the licensing of additional people, we believe the number would be fairly small, because we probably already licensed the majority of them. It's simply, if there is harm to the consumer, there's nothing we can do about it. So I don't believe that it's really about keeping people out of the industry. Most of the people are already licensed by us, but there's no jurisdiction over the preparation of those entity returns.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. So let's say, for instance, that somebody has a partnership return that needs to be done, or an S corporation. and they live out of state, but it's an Oregon S Corp. And so they'd get their CPA over in Vancouver, who is not licensed in Oregon, to go ahead and prep their tax return, fully a CPA, knowledgeable of the law, followed the Oregon law. Would that CPA in Vancouver then have to be licensed under this? Because the way I read it, they would.
No.
No.
or tax preparer, even if it's not CPA.
Yeah. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, what our statute covers is those who do not work for, are not licensed by a CPA or work for a CPA, those who are not an attorney or work for an attorney. So those are our exclusions already. So if you work for an attorney, it also only covers those who prepare returns while they are physically in Oregon or advertise in Oregon. Someone out of state, as long as they don't advertise in Oregon, again, we have no jurisdiction over them, which those number we believe overall are small. And if they work for CPA from another state, certainly they would not be under our jurisdiction already under the exclusion of the current statute.
Questions? More questions? Okay. Well, I think this is I think it's a good piece of legislation. I think the real question would be to ask, since we license the individuals, you know, the question would be, if we assume this is good law, and I think it is, and protecting, and then would be, why would we treat a corporate return different than a personal return if we think the policy in terms of preparation. So, again, this is just a public hearing today. We'll bring the bill back another time. And if the committee has any more questions, please have Mr. Stenberg so we can pass those on. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172, and I believe our mayor has arrived. So I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 147 and ask Mr. Wendell if he'd like to come forward. And Mr. Wendell, I don't know if you've been prepped on this. We've pretty well had a discussion of the bill, but we had some questions, and you, just because of your mayorship, might have some insight, because some of the questions that were asked about was municipal water systems and others, do people and utilities, do other entities have trouble from people who are unlicensed using compressed air? I mean, has it created issues? And that may not be something you would know, but I just wanted to let you know that that was part of the discussion. So I'll let you give your testimony and then and see if there's some questions.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this time to come and talk to you about Senate Bill 147, I believe it is. If you don't mind, let me give you a little bit of personal background. Of course, I'm the mayor of the city of Prineville. I myself am a general contractor. My wife is a landscape contractor. I'm also the chair of Central Oregon Cities Organization, and don't hold it against me, but I currently work for Oregon Department of Transportation. So I have quite a bit of background in a lot of different areas. Sometimes my city staff prefers it, but sometimes when I've seen some of the systems that we've allowed over the years installed and connected to our municipal water, sometimes I have a few questions for staff that why we ever allowed some of these things to be installed the way they were. And you know, as we grow as a community and we learn from our experiences and have improved in our, what we require in services. So over the years, it's been sort of a challenge for me, but it's been also a great learning experience for myself also. My wife and I, with our landscape business, we test backflows and we do irrigation repairs, installation systems all over Central Oregon, Burns, Prineville, Redmond, anywhere. So we see a lot of different municipal systems. If you go to City of Bend, I believe there's three or four municipal water districts there, so we have to deal with all those on a private side, and then I also deal with them on a public side also. So it's sort of interesting to see the differences of standards and requirements for those. One of the things that we found out this last year is that at the time you did not you were not required to have a license to do irrigation blowouts. From a personal stance, I have the ability to govern a little bit different than other places do because I have the personal background to understand some of the systems that are being put into the ground. And some of them are pretty scary. They really are pretty scary. Some of them are hooked right into the municipal water systems. Some of them have, you know, 30 years old that have been hooked into the municipal water systems. And the cities have an unbelievable challenge to try and manage how those connections are made. What you run into is you run into people that have access to municipal water that, for lack of a better word, probably shouldn't have access to the municipal water. So it has been a challenge in our community. It has been a challenge in the city of Bend. Avion, I don't know. Avion is a water district that deals with an area of Bend. I don't know if they've had much of a challenge with it at all, but I've seen it both on the from the private sector and from the public sector that there is an issue out there. I strongly encourage that Senate Bill 147 be passed. It will be a benefit to the contractors, to the water purveyors, and to the citizens because you have a licensed contractor and they have the ability, they have the insurance and the bonding.
Thank you, Mr. Webb.
Does that help out?
It does. Any questions for the mayor?
I just do have one general question that popped into my head. I'm not even sure, Mayor, that you're the appropriate person, but how much is the license? What is that information? Can somebody just tell me?
I think we'd have to get Mr. Snyder.
Yeah, I think we do. But as you were talking about, again, consumer protection, and then, of course, you've got a provider. And so if someone legitimately wants to do this kind of work, how much is it? What are the fees that the provider has to pay to
Chairman Metzger and Senator Schrader?
Yeah.
Again, my name is Mike Snyder of the Landscape Contractors Board. I'm the administrator of the Landscape mm-hmm. Contractors Board. Currently, there's two licenses required to perform landscape work in the state of Oregon. One is an individual license for a landscape construction professional, and that license is $75 per year.
Okay.
And then there's a landscape contracting business license, and that's the entity that enters into contracts and provides the consumer protection. That's the entity that carries the bond and the insurance and the workers' comp if they have employees. That license is $225 per year. So you add those two together, and it's $300 per year to have a landscape contracting business license.
This license and bond. Okay, thank you for that.
Okay. Any other questions? On a different subject, since you're here and you're visiting us today with all the other mayors, what's the mood of things in Prineville? How are things going there with, you know, the economy and everything? I know Les Schwab is your big business there, and I toured their whole facility just a number of months ago and talked to some folks out there. So I just wondering, from what are you hearing and what are the challenges you guys are facing?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, as you know, Les Schwab's main office has moved to Bend. It is a pretty tough time. I just looked at the unemployment numbers yesterday, and we're at 14%, way higher than I wanted. It actually opened up a side discussion of how they calculate. Are those unemployment numbers based on where you're employed or whether you reside? You know, I didn't know at the time, and I'm still not totally sure. But you know, Prineville is, whether we like it or not, we are a bedroom community of the metropolis of Bend. So it has affected us quite drastically, it's interesting to see that I think it might give us some different opportunities and some different avenues. One of the issues that we're dealing with in Prineville is our rail, and we're pushing our rail access quite drastically, especially as Central Oregon grows. To move freight in and out of Central Oregon on the current highway system is a challenge, mm-hmm. and it will continue to be a challenge as Central Oregon continues to be one of the fastest growing areas in the state of Oregon. So it will be a challenge for us to keep the railroad afloat right now. We're doing everything we can as long as we can. We're looking at some long-term funding for it. But I tell people every day we will do everything that we possibly can to keep it afloat and keep it moving. But the employment picture is the same as anywhere else. Transportation is can continue to be tough. Again, I can't thank you enough. Connect Oregon 1, Connect Oregon 2, both of those were just fantastic for our communities. I had Representative Gilman over there in Prineville just the other week immediately asked me for some pictures, so I will have pictures, and we'll be getting pictures to everybody. About 3 weeks ago, I had about 20 to 25 people out there pouring concrete, building forms on that site that you yourselves helped support. So thank you very much for that, and we look forward to doing more projects like that in the future.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I know you have challenges like we all do, and best of luck with those. And certainly the rail issue is one that we're working on, and working on at this very moment on the one that goes from Eugene to Coos Bay and trying to come up with $16 million in the next 18 days. You know, having visited out there a number of times the last couple of years and understand the challenges you face about businesses who want to put cars on, and, you know, the railroad likes to go 100 miles before they stop and load up again, and they don't really want to stop there, but we've got business opportunities if we can work out some ways to bring that commerce to the railroad and the railroad accepting it, when the downturn becomes an upturn, we'd like to be able to have that opportunity. So we'll look forward to working with you on that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Katie, for the indulgence. I thought with our mayor here, it'd be nice to hear what's going on in other parts of the state. So we'll bring this back later. We'll close the public hearing. And before we adjourn, Jim, just tell us a bit about tomorrow.
Thank you for asking, Mr. Chairman. I was prepared. I brought tomorrow's agenda with me today, so I can tell you. We have four bills that were submitted through the governor by the Department of Transportation.
About Transportation Day. So
Transportation
Day. So when you have a moment, and none of us have a lot of moments, but take to look over those bills, and we'll be doing our first full day on transportation tomorrow. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I might also mention that last Thursday we had a discussion of the two bridges. One proposed over the Columbia River, one actually over the Mississippi River there in Minnesota. The Department of Transportation supplied a single-page description of those two projects, and each of the members has been given a copy of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then, in addition, you have the kind of the work plan that we did with the Senate President, but tomorrow we're going to do the two-week rolling agendas passed out. Is that what we decided, Thursday or...?
Whatever you wish.
Yeah, well, I think we decided Thursday. Is members, just to kind of help out, is beginning tomorrow and then each Thursday, each week, Mr. Stenberg will give you, will hand out a two-week work plan of what's going to be scheduled and what days, so you have a chance to kind of look ahead and see what the bills are and have a chance to review those, and also give Senator Starr and myself input on, especially where there are days where there may be some things that we'd like to add to the agenda. We'd like to hear from you about that. They seem compatible with the other issues. So that way you just have a little more planning time. You know, we have a 48-hour thing, but I think as best as possible, 2 weeks for both those who would like to come visit with us, as well as our own preparation. That would be helpful. So we'll make a point of doing that each week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very nice. For those of us that are a little distance away from Salem, it gives us an opportunity if we have people in our communities that would like to testify. So I appreciate that very much.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, Senator Verger, we hope that we can run you out of town on a rail.
That's right.
The one from Eugene to Coos Bay.
That's right.
Okay. If there's no other business to come before the committee, we're adjourned.
Thank you.